This is Crossroads, a Get Religion podcast.
Dinanzi alla piaga degli abusi sessuali perpetrati da uomini di chiesa a danno dei minori, ho pensato di interpellare voi, patriarchi, cardinali, arcivescovi, vescovi.
That is Pope Francis opening a three-day meeting Thursday at the Vatican on the clergy's sexual abuse crisis. He concluded those opening remarks by saying, "We hear the cry of the little ones asking for justice." That phrase, little ones, invokes what picture? Children. Of course, the clergy abuse crisis has expanded far beyond the abuse, the sexual abuse of children. It is now including seminarians, nuns, and young boys. In fact, predominantly young boys or teenage boys. Will that part of the clergy abuse crisis be addressed? Will it be covered in the media coverage of this meeting at the Vatican? Greetings and welcome to Crossroads with Terry Mattingly. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
So the news is already starting to come back over here from Rome. What are we hearing so far?
Well, we have a short but important statement from the Pope. And for people who have listened to our discussions in the past here at Issues and in the podcast for Get Religion, frankly, a lot of what I'm going to say here initially is going to sound pretty familiar, because so far a lot of the issues we expected to come up have come up. In his very first statement, the Pope came right out of the gate and called this a scandal about pedophilia. Now you say, well, isn't that what this is about? Well, that's been one of the issues all along, is whether or not this really is a scandal in which the majority of the cases involve children, prepubescent children, as opposed to people who are right on the doorstep of puberty and then into the teenage years. Most people, I think, agree on the statistic that approximately 80% of the abuse cases involve priests or other clergy with teenaged boys, or specifically boys who were courted, so to speak, or kind of steered into these relationships when they were like 11 years old or 12 years old, and then the relationships go into the teenage years. So the Pope has used the word pedophilia right up front. And this, you know, when you hear someone say the little ones, what age group do you think of?
Well, I mean, immediately in my mind, especially coming from a religious person, I think tiny children.
Right.
Toddlers and infants and things like that.
Yeah. You don't think 13, 14, 15 year old teens. You know, are not. Now, the word children has always been vague through all of this, as has the word boys. You know, when you think of boys, you can think of people at the Lincoln Memorial, you know, who are Catholic boys or Catholic teens. I mean, those words have been kind of handled in a very vague manner. And that's it. I know I talk about this a lot, but it's extremely important to understand the history of this scandal and to understand how important the distinction between small children and teenaged victims, how big a distinction that is and how important it is in the history of the scandal. Let me give you just a little bit of background on why that's so important. Back in the 80s, in the 1980s, when I first started covering this scandal, when it began to break into the public view in 1984, 1985, I had a long conversation with someone who was at a treatment center for Catholic clergy with sexual abuse problems. We now know that this particular center was, you know, at the center of the exploding sexual abuse problems in the late 70s and early 80s. And this person, this counselor, mentioned a distinction that I hadn't thought of. He said, the bishops right now, they know that when you're dealing with a true pedophile, they know that true pedophiles cannot be treated. You don't treat someone for pedophilia. You lock them up, or you put them as far from children as you can possibly get them. Now, once again, pedophilia there is defined as a driving desire to have sexual contact with the little ones, with children, with people, children up to puberty. And then he made a comment. He said, the bishops at this point seem to think that you can treat men who aren't really pedophiles but have been violating their celibacy vows. And I followed up and said, you mean with teenagers? You mean with teenage boys in particular? And he immediately clammed up in terms of not wanting to talk about that. But stop and think about it. If this is the ground zero of the scandal, is the late 70s and the early 80s, if you look at this statistically, and we saw that in the Pennsylvania report. What if lots of bishops at that point really did think, I'm going to have to get rid of the pedophiles, but these guys who are acting out with teenagers and young adults and whatever, maybe we can send them away for therapy and we can get them cleaned up and we can bring them back. If that's what the bishops were hearing at that stage of the game, that's just astonishingly important in terms of explaining what we're still dealing with here today. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, so you're saying that the scandal was probably fueled in some way, and the continuing activity was fueled in some way by just bad information.
Bad information and good intent to some degree. Now, you could say, well, that's bad intent for victims, but not if you have counselors telling you, no, we can make these guys right again. We can pick out the bad apples from the good ones, and you can get these priests back. Now, remember that at that same time, in that same era, the full impact of the shortage of Catholic priests and the fall off in vocations post-Vatican II is really beginning to hit. I mean, in some dioceses, we're talking about a significant number of priests that you are talking about just taking them completely out of ministry. That must have scared the daylights out of a lot of bishops and out of their priests who were in charge of just starting to trying to keep the parishes open. That situation's a lot worse now, but the bishops have come to realize, as we saw in the Dallas Charter of 2002, no, abuse is abuse. Yes, there are pedophiles. Yes, there are ephebophiles, people driven to have sexual contact with post-pubescent young people. Yes, those are two different things, but we're talking about sin and crime. And we are going to have to get our act together. And a big part of the story right now is that in America, a lot of standards that were a part of that 2002 charter have actually had a very positive effect. And I think a lot of even the harshest critics of the church would admit that those standards have had a positive effect. Part of what we're seeing in Rome right now is whether or not those same kinds of standards can be applied to the rest of the world, whether a lot of other bishops are willing to go there.
Rod Dreher, I talked with him yesterday, and he recently wrote a piece, and he simply referred to this meeting that's taking place at the Vatican as a sham Rome meeting. What do you think he meant, and do you concur?
Well, I don't think we know yet. One of the most important things that happened very early is while the Pope made his initial remarks, which were very short, according to the always essential website Whispers in the Loggia, Rocco Palmo, and that blog that he runs, they handed out a 21-point set of talking points for what the crucial issues were that needed to be addressed in this meeting and in this crisis. And what's interesting to me is those talking points are actually pretty good. There are things in them that, I'll be honest, I kind of wondered if we would hear these topics surface at all during the meetings. Now, this probably is going to be in the news reports that we see in the next 24 hours or so going into Friday newspapers, Friday television shows, etc. So let me actually read a couple of these talking points. Among the 21, number 7 is establish specific protocols for handling accusations against bishops. Now, one of the big stories here, especially with the Ted McCarrick scandal and a bunch of other ones, only the Vatican can do disciplinary proceedings against bishops, archbishops, let alone cardinals. So establish specific protocols for handling accusations. That's good, but that's not the same thing as saying make a change in them or try to open them up so that we can hear more often from lay people or others. So how that gets addressed is crucial. There's another point where that hints at this, though. Number 13, establish provisions that regulate and facilitate, that's a good word, facilitate, the participation of lay experts in investigations and in the different degrees of judgment of canonical processes concerning sexual and or power abuse. Now, if that is applied to bishops to some degree, which would, that's a serious issue in Catholic polity, that would be a huge door. And listeners may recall that the U.S. bishops wanted to do exactly that, and Rome shut them down a number of weeks ago and said, wait, we'll handle that in Rome. And a lot of U.S. bishops were extremely disappointed that they weren't able to put kind of Dallas 2002 type laity exposure methodology where people could testify to lay boards and independent boards and make accusations that could then be checked out. What will happen to that? Hang tight. Let me give you two more. Number 16, you know how important I think the word seminarians is. Introduce rules concerning seminarians and candidates for the priesthood or religious life. Be sure there are programs of initial and ongoing formation to help them develop their human, spiritual, and psychosexual maturity, as well as their interpersonal relationships and their behavior. Number 17, be sure to have psychological evaluations by qualified and accredited experts for candidates for the priesthood and consecrated life. Now, when you hear 16 and 17, I mean, you've been to seminary, you are in a Protestant context, but when you hear people start talking about psychosexual maturity and psychological evaluations in the context of these Catholic scandals, what do you hear there?
Well, I think they're trying to weed out, I guess my initial reaction is they're trying to identify potential pedophiles or phobophiles. I don't know if they mean homosexuals or not.
Yes, and that's really the issue here. And I'm not one of those people who think that homosexuality is the whole story here. I think it's a large part of a bigger picture that, you know, we've discussed before. But let me, this really, when I read those phrases, I had this flashback in my brain back to the mid-1980s when I began covering this. Early on, some of us would go, lots of reporters would go to meetings of the U.S. Catholic Bishops Conference. And I remember in particular meetings in Collegeville, Minnesota. Now, what, this is like 30 years ago now or more. And what would happen is they would have a bunch of public meetings, and then the bishops would go into private executive session. Now, this was already after the initial cases of really serious abuse had begun to blow up and be made public. In 1984, 1985, in particular some cases in Louisiana. So in that period, 86, 85, 86, 87, the bishops were starting to talk about this, but reporters didn't get to hear them talk about it because they were doing it in executive session. So the post I put up today at Get Religion opens with a tea leaves image, because what would happen is when the minutes would come out months later, the minutes of the meeting, we would all read the minutes very carefully and compare them with our notes. And when we hit subjects that we know were not discussed in open session, we knew that that must have been material they discussed in closed session without reporters present. Well, why I had this flashback when reading this memo that was handed out at the Vatican earlier today, the phrases that we began to look for were twofold. One of them was the phrase psychosexual maturity, and the other was psychological evaluations of priests. We need to know more about the psychological health of our, that's another phrase, psychological health of our potential priests. They were already talking behind closed doors about all of these important issues. And what were they talking about? We still don't know today. But we can look at these talking points. If these talking points end up being the framework for what happens this weekend in this crucial meeting at the Vatican, basically, I think listeners need to realize that three different things could happen here. Number one, these talking points and the subject of what happens to seminarians and protocols for handling accusations against bishops, we're going to have to see if that ends up being discussed in public sessions with reporters present. Okay? Number two, we could be back to the tea leaves. What happens if these are discussed in private sessions? At which point, we don't know whether these subjects ended up being talked about at all. I mean, there could actually be, when push comes to shove, they've mentioned these subjects. They want us to know that they know this is important, but will this be discussed? Or will there be silence behind those closed doors? Silence or debate, either way, the public and the press isn't going to find out about it. And then finally, the other thing that could happen here that we've all got to watch for is what happens if after this meeting, which is going to occur for several days, there's going to be, you and I talked several weeks ago about, I predicted that there would be a penitential service with some sort of very visual act of repentance by the Pope and maybe selected cardinals, perhaps with victims present. You know, flashback on that in your own mind. I think I told you what would happen. How much would TV stations like it? How would TV cameramen and editors and producers like it if the Pope did a ritual in which he ended up prostrating at the feet of a circle or a line of victims and begging them for their forgiveness and his own repentance? Would you think the TV stations would cover that?
I think that if we saw a picture, a visual of the Pope showing very obvious repentance before victims at this meeting, it would be so big that it would actually push Gussie Smollett off the headlines for a day or two.
And the people in Virginia would be even more relieved, right? Democratic Party leaders in Virginia. Yeah, and to some degree, this would be very effective media management in that the visuals would overwhelm the very complicated topics that either would be covered or not be covered. And never forget that there is basically no television operation in America that has a religion specialist, anyone who knows all the history of this. So yeah, I mean, part of me would say, as moving as that scene might be, we still have to look behind the scenes and say, okay, what did they do? And what did they discuss, and what did they not discuss? Those remain the big issues, no matter what.
Should the media cover this as one crisis?
Yeah, that's a really crucial point. There was an excellent piece the other day that ran in the Atlantic. Emma Green, of course, their fine religion correspondent. And she did a lengthy interview with Cardinal O'Malley of Boston, who is the subject of some intrigue right now concerning these meetings, in that he has been the face of this crisis in terms of trying to solve it in the United States, the man who has probably done more than any other to help create the Dallas standards and push them in different places. And he had to clean up Boston, you know, in the wake of the spotlight crisis of 2002. O'Malley's doesn't appear to be a part of this meeting in Rome. And instead, the Americans who are in strong leadership positions are all people, quite frankly, who have a history of being connected to former cardinal and now former priest Theodore McCarrick. And this has raised a lot of eyebrows. Was O'Malley insisting that Rome investigate McCarrick? Was he insisting that Rome put in place procedures to help handle bishops? Why is O'Malley not at the forefront of this meeting in Rome? But even with that said, there's one simple sentence in this lengthy piece at the Atlantic that I think gets to the heart of what you're asking. We can deal with this pretty quickly. The problem, O'Malley repeatedly suggested, is mostly fixed in the U.S. It just requires tinkering around the edges. The problem. The assumption here is that there is one problem. And I think if we know anything at this point, is that there are multiple problems that are a part of this crisis. Whatever you think of all the interlinking causes, at the very least, we have five different problems just in terms of types of abuse. Let me list them real quickly. First of all, we do have some cases, small numbers, but we do have genuine pedophilia, sex with children. Then we have the overwhelming statistical abuse situation, which is sex with teenagers. We then have abuse of adults. Now, I'm separating that from a fourth category, which is abuse of seminarians and nuns. Priests, say, abusing adults or something in their parishes, or male or female or whatever, that's a different thing than the abuse of seminarians who are directly under the control of the church. And the same thing is true of nuns. So I would separate that into two different abuse crises. And then finally, the one that nobody seems to want to talk about is the simple problem of consensual sex with adults, which isn't a crime, but it is a violation of the vows that clergy have taken. And that then opens a door into a whole other set of problems. When you see the media coverage in the next couple of days, and it's going to come like tsunami waves after an earthquake, there's going to be so much stuff that we'll all have trouble reading it all. Keep thinking, is this one problem, or is it actually five problems? Sex with children, sex with teens, sex and abuse with adults, sex and abuse with seminarians and or nuns, a problem that's now beginning to blow up, and finally, just consensual sex that shatters the vows that a priest takes. Those are five different issues. This is not a single problem.
Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He is founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, thanks for the time. I look forward to next week's conversation.
Glad to talk to you.
I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you next week. Thanks for listening to Crossroads with Terry Mattingly.
Crossroads is a joint production of GetReligion.org and Issues Etc.